Deutsche Welle Spotlight on Europe.
Hello, welcome to our weekly program Spotlight on Europe. I am Zipporah Nyambura in Bonn. On today's program, a nation divided as Catalonia insists it wants to break away from Spain.
It's difficult for both sides because they've become so entrenched in their respective positions. The Spanish government insists it can't negotiate with the Catalan government as long as it's insisting on wanting a referendum. So that's a problem. And the Catalan government insists that if it can't hold a formal referendum, it will simply break away.
Plus, Germany celebrates Unity Day, but how united is the country 27 years after reunification?
The ties between West and East Germany have become much closer than they were after Germany's reunification in 1990, but there are a number of differences which are still remaining.
Stay tuned for an in-depth look at what is happening across Europe. It's been a week of drama and confusion following demands for self-determination or independence across several regions around the world. In Cameroon, 17 people died during protests in support of the country's restive Anglophone population, which is trying to break away from the French-speaking majority. Here in Europe, Catalonia is piling on the pressure to break away from Spain following last Sunday's referendum. The separatist authorities in Catalonia estimated that 90% of the vote was for leaving Spain, but less than half the population actually voted in the referendum, which had already been declared illegal by the Spanish government. On Sunday, the peaceful intentions of the referendum were marred by violence and division, as Lauren Freya found when she attended a polling station in the Catalan capital, Barcelona.
The chants of "We will vote" began before dawn at this school-turned-polling station in Barcelona's center. José Papel Sánchez, who is 81, linked arms with teenagers as they all prepared to block police from entering. Spain had ruled the referendum illegal and ordered police to stop it.
Por defender la democracia.
We're defending democracy, she says, and if we get independence, that's even better. She was born the year the Spanish Civil War began. She lived through the nearly 40-year dictatorship of Francisco Franco, when Catalan language and culture were repressed.
Maria, al marchar.
Local police came and left with no attempt to crack down on their fellow Catalans. People inside applauded them. They're on our side, 81-year-old Rosé whispered. Ballot boxes hidden in trash bags were smuggled in by volunteers, and about an hour later, the first votes were cast. Some wiped away happy tears and breathed a collective sigh of relief. Voting was underway. But then national police, shipped in from all over the country, rolled in. Spanish police smashed their way into a polling station just around the corner from here, beating voters and confiscating ballot boxes by force. Elsewhere, they fired rubber bullets and tear gas. Nearly 1,000 people were hurt. Rosé says she feels like she's reliving history.
Claro, claro, es que son los mismos con diferentes, ¿cómo se llama? Los mismos personajes con diferentes vestidos.
They're the same people in different clothes, she says. Spain's ruling Conservative Party was founded in part by former Franco-era ministers. As word of the violence outside spreads through the crowd inside this polling station, at first people are incredulous, then angry.
Personally, it shocks me, but it's a bit sad.
Xavier Oliver is a Catalan software developer who lives in Scotland. He voted for independence there in a referendum 3 years ago. Now he's flown home to Barcelona to vote for independence in this one. He says with Spanish police using violence against their own citizens, it's time for the European Union to intervene.
You can't just look away while this happens. You can't. I mean, sure, EU is about money and economy, sure. But at some point you have to pretend, you know, that some of the values that you proclaim are true.
Many Catalans still managed to cast ballots, 90% of them in favor of independence, though half of Catalans did not vote. Anti-secession parties boycotted the whole thing. Still, Madrid's measures to halt separatism here appear to have fueled it. Sunday was a rainy day. Some voters may have planned to stay home. But when they flipped on the TV and saw violence at the polls, they were all the more determined to vote, says this voter, Pep Planas.
They made people change their minds and say, I want to vote now. I think that some people did this switch.
That is not what Spain had in mind when it sent police to halt this referendum.
First of all, I think the central government overestimated its ability to actually stop the vote from happening.
Federico Santi is a political analyst at the London-based Eurasia Group. He says it was a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't situation for Spanish leaders in Madrid.
Eventually, they would have to intervene sooner or later. Better to do it sooner than do it later after the referendum has taken place, which I think would have resulted in an even stronger explicit political mandate for the regional government to actually pursue secession.
The Catalan president says he's already got that mandate and wants Europe to help mediate a transition to Catalan statehood. But both Madrid and Brussels have nixed that. An EU spokesman, Margaritis Schinas, took to a podium.
We trust the leadership of Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy to manage this difficult process in full respect of the Spanish Constitution and of the fundamental rights of citizens enshrined therein.
In other words, EU policy has not changed. Catalan separatism remains an internal Spanish matter. That's disappointing to Catalans, who had hoped the vote and violence that marred it would lead to international sympathy, if not independence. Lauren Freyer, DW, Barcelona.
Calls for a dialogue between the two sides have so far been futile. But with such hardline positions, is there even any way back from Sunday's events? And if so, which way would that be? A question Emma Wallace posed to our correspondent Guy Hedgeko, who was in Catalonia for the referendum.
It's difficult for both sides because they've become so entrenched in their respective positions. The Spanish government insists it can't negotiate with the Catalan government as long as it's insisting on wanting a referendum. So that's a problem. And the Catalan government insists that if it can't hold a formal referendum, it will simply break away, pointing to the referendum it's already held. So they're very entrenched on either side. All the talk now is about the possibility of mediation. It looks like there's probably not going to be international mediation. The European Commission seems to have ruled that out, at least for the moment. But the Catalan government and the Catalan president, Carles Puigdemont, have said they want some kind of mediation. And there seems to be a lot of activity going on behind the scenes in Spanish politics and outside the political sphere as well to try and find someone, a party, an agent who would be able to mediate and who would be acceptable to both parties. Now, the latest we've heard is that the Catholic Church has been in touch with the Spanish government. That might be a way out of this because the Catholic Church is very close to Mariano Rajoy's Conservative Popular Party. And it's obviously it's not an outside agent. It's present in Spain as well. So that might be a possibility here. But we don't know if that mediation will be accepted by either or both sides yet.
Talking of Mariano Rajoy, he has actually stated that he won't mediate because the referendum, in his eyes, was illegal anyway. So why is he sticking to such a hard line?
Well, I think you have to take into account that he's responding to a lot of pressures in the rest of Spain. Now, there is his own popular party, which is a conservative party, and it has quite a hard right wing to it, to his right, which doesn't want to make any concessions whatsoever. And so I think if he did, perhaps he wonders if he'd be risking a revolt in his own party and therefore his own position. There's also a lot of pressure from the right-wing media in Madrid, which is very powerful, very influential. And there are the pressures from his own voters across the rest of Spain. Now, you know, his own voters tend to be on the right of the political spectrum, older voters, voters who are adamant that Spain should remain united and see the Catalan independence push and the referendum project, they see it the same way that Rajoy does, as any illegal project that can't be justified. So he's got all those different pressures on him. Therefore, he simply doesn't want to be seen to be giving ground to the Catalan government. He feels that if he does sit down and negotiate, there's a risk that he'll be seen to be giving in to blackmail. That's what he's been saying so far. So that would seem to be why he is resisting at the moment.
There's been lots of comparisons between the Scottish referendum for independence a few years ago in the UK and the Catalonian referendum. Why didn't Mariano Rajoy try and put a case for why Catalonia should stay within Spain, why they wanted them to all be one big happy family? Because surely if he had handled things more like David Cameron perhaps handled things, then some of this confusion and chaos could have been avoided.
It's a really good point, because a lot of people have said, you know, why has there not been a more emotional appeal by the Spanish government to Catalans? Because their approach basically has been almost entirely legal. It hasn't even been political. They haven't engaged politically with the Catalan government, and they certainly haven't made any kind of emotional overtures saying, we want you to stay because you're so important to us in so many different ways, not just economically, but also culturally and socially. We haven't really heard any of that from the Spanish government. It's all been based on the law. And I think that just tells you a lot about Mariano Rajoy as a politician. He's not very charismatic. He's not a very exciting figure. He likes to stick by the rules. So he simply points to the Constitution as his argument. And so anything outside that is breaking the law in his mind. And that is at the very heart of this conflict.
How divided is Spain as a whole about this issue, would you say?
I think it is pretty divided. I mean, obviously, the really obvious division is in Catalonia itself. But when you get outside Catalonia, in recent days, interestingly, we've seen a number of demonstrations, quite big demonstrations, out on the street of Madrid and also other cities around the country in favour of them being able to stage a referendum in Catalonia, so in favour of the right to decide. So that would suggest that there is a division, because I think it's fair to say the majority of Spaniards outside Catalonia back Rajoy's position on this. But if you look more at the left of the political spectrum, people who vote, for example, for the party Podemos, that new leftist party, which is the third force in the Spanish parliament, they don't agree with the Spanish government on this. They think it should offer some kind of negotiation on a pacted resolution. So there is a division there. It's not as simple as the Catalans want a referendum or want independence and the rest of the country is opposed. There are kind of other dynamics at work there in the rest of the country. And so it is a very divisive situation across the board. Amazingly enough, we've seen it even within the Spanish soccer team. You know, Gerard Piqué, who was in favour of the referendum, he's a Catalan footballer who's played for the Spanish team for years. He was booed at a training camp for the Spanish national team the other day by Spanish fans because of his political views, essentially. And there are suggestions that there is even some kind of split within the Spanish soccer team. So this political situation has encouraged ordinary Spaniards across the country to sort of take sides in a way.
What happens if or when Catalonia declares independence?
There is an option for the Spanish government, which is an article in the Constitution. It's become a rather a sort of infamous article because it's been debated and talked about so much in recent months, called Article 155. And it's never been used before. And if it was triggered, it would allow the central government to step in and take control of the powers of a particular region. Spain has these 17 different regions, and in this case, it would be taking over powers in Catalonia. It's all very mysterious, the exact extent of what Article 155 would allow. But it would, for example, mean that the central government could call a regional election in Catalonia, which is something that the Catalan regional government should normally do. It would allow the central government to take control of the Catalan police force, take control of other areas that are normally under the control of the regional government. Now, that would be seen as very much a kind of nuclear option by the Spanish government. It's looking quite possible, but it would be very drastic, because the feeling is that then that might escalate things further, because it would be seen as provocative to the Catalan independence movement, and then they would feel the need to respond, perhaps by pushing ahead even quicker with their own independence plans, after a declaration, perhaps pushing through their plans to hold some kind of constituent election and so on.
If Catalonia declares independence, presumably they'd have to leave Europe and then reapply to join as a separate state?
Well, that has been one of the biggest arguments of the unionist, the Spanish unionist camp, if you like, against the Catalan independence movement. They say, if you leave, the rules say you have to reapply for membership, and then there's all, you know, all the problems you have with the currency. What currency will you use and so on? Now, clearly, the Catalan government has always talked about its project as being, you know, part of Europe. It wants to be an independent state within Europe. So that clearly is an issue. But they also argue that Catalonia is so important, above all, economically for Europe, that it would simply not make sense for it to be left out of the bloc, that if it did break away, the EU would simply have to accept it straight away as a member again, because it has this huge tourism sector, it has huge other industries. It's the biggest economy in Spain, it has an economy that's bigger than that of Portugal. So just in pure economic terms, the Catalan independence camp argues that it wouldn't make sense to leave Catalonia out in the cold. No one really knows how this is going to turn out. It's a pretty unprecedented situation. I mean, clearly, this is the deepest political crisis Spain has had for decades, but it's a major crisis for Europe as well. And for the moment, Europe doesn't seem to want to get involved. It's such a thorny issue. But it creates all these issues. There are economic issues, political issues, the idea of other regions following suit. So it's a huge challenge, not just for the Spanish government, but I think it might become a huge challenge for the European Union further along down the line.
Emma Wall is talking to Guy Hedgeko. Here in Germany, the country just celebrated its Tag der Einheit, or Unity Day, a day set aside to celebrate the reunification of Germany 27 years ago. But after the recent general elections, there are many questions as to whether the country is really united. This election was the first time a right-wing populist party, the Alternative for Deutschland, or AfD, was voted into parliament. The majority of those who voted for the AfD are from the East, which has made some political analysts wonder whether there's still an imaginary wall dividing Germany between East and West. That was a question Emma Wallis put to DW's Berlin correspondent Daniel Pels.
The ties between West and East Germany have become much closer than they were after Germany's reunification in 1990, but there are a number of differences which are still remaining. East Germany is still poorer by German standards than West Germany. The average salaries in East Germany are still lower than those in West Germany. Unemployment, on the other hand, is higher. And East Germany's economic power is about one-third lower than that of West Germany. There isn't any major German company that has its headquarters in East Germany or has a large manufacturing plant there. So there are still a number of differences, particular economic differences, remaining.
The AfD vote, the Alternative for Deutschland vote, perhaps highlights the differences in the country most starkly. But surely those divisions, as you've already slightly outlined, have always been there.
Yes, absolutely. West Germany and East Germany were divided over 40 years, and they were two very different countries. West Germany was a free market democracy, and East Germany was a socialist one-party state. The interesting thing is that in the first years after German reunification, there was a lot of coverage in the media about the differences between East and West Germany, not just the economic problems in East Germany, but also the feeling among many East Germans that the West Germans were not taking them seriously, or many East Germans complaining about what they called a kind of superiority complex by many West Germans. But for some reason, many of these reports disappeared in recent years. There wasn't much attention given to the struggles many people still face in East Germany. And I think the election results are now reminding Germans that these differences between East and West Germany are actually still there.
You talked about the differences in economics, in rich and poor. But instead of seeing Germany as still divided by some form of invisible wall between East and West, would you say that the divisions in Germany today are more about rich and poor all over the country? Because, for instance, if you use this vote for the AfD as one of the barometers of division, then people voted for them also in southern Germany and also in some of the former mining areas in the west, like the Ruhrgebiet, for instance.
Well, it's something that Federal President Frank-Walter Steinmeier touched on when he gave his speech on German Reunification Day this year. He said that the wall that separated East and West Germany had disappeared, but that there are new and invisible walls. He also said partially between the rich and the poor, but then also between rural and urban areas, between those people who are online using the internet and those people that are offline. The election results did show that in a way. The AfD did well in many regions where people are not that well off, where unemployment is high, and where people are very worried, for instance, how they're going to survive in old age because they are afraid that their pensions won't be sufficient to allow them to have a decent life in old age. But the AfD is not just a poor man's party. It also managed to attract a lot of voters in rural areas. And I think the gap between rural and urban areas in Germany is also widening. I mean, if you take Brandenburg, for example, that's the province that is surrounding the capital, Berlin. The population is shrinking. Many villages are losing residents because the young people are moving to Berlin and to other bigger cities looking for work there. And in many areas, you know, schools have closed, hospitals have closed, police stations have been closed, public transport like buses has been cut. Many villages do not even have a grocery shop or bakery. So you can see that the lifestyle is really different between the urban and the rural areas. Life in a way is also getting much harder, for instance, for old people who don't have a car, who are not able to drive anymore, for instance, to the nearest shop or to the nearest municipality if they need a new identity card or something of the sort. So I think divisions within German society are not just between rich and poor, but also mainly between rural and urban areas.
What are the politicians proposing to do about these divisions across the country?
What I found interesting was that Chancellor Angela Merkel mentioned in a speech she gave in front of the media a day after the elections that more work would need to be done, for example, to improve the medical support in rural areas, because also a lot of doctors have stopped practicing, have left those areas, complaining over poor pay and very poor working conditions. And you didn't hear much from very senior German politicians, the Chancellor or the President, for example, about the situation in rural areas in recent years. And now, a day after the election success of the AfD, the Chancellor all of a sudden mentioned that more attention should be given to rural areas. So I think through this election result, a lot of people in Berlin have actually woken up and realized there is something we need to do. But then it remains to be seen what will actually be done, because Germany, first of all, needs a new government that can actually implement or finance new policies to develop the rural areas.
That was DW's Daniel Pels talking to Emma Wallis. The French Parliament has adopted an anti-terrorism bill that will boost police surveillance powers and make it easier to close mosques suspected of preaching hate. France has suffered a number of terror attacks in recent years for which so-called Islamic State has claimed responsibility. Just this week, the Eiffel Tower in Paris went dark to mark two brutal attacks in Las Vegas and in the French port city of Marseille. In both cases, IS claimed responsibility. As our correspondent in France, Lisa Bryant, reports, the incident may help fuel support for new anti-terrorism legislation that is currently making its way through Parliament.
Moments of silence were held at France's National Assembly, small towns, and the universities they attended for cousins Morane and Laura, the two young students who were stabbed to death at Marseille's train station by a man shouting Allahu Akbar. Patrolling soldiers shot him dead minutes later. Islamic State claimed responsibility, although investigators found no immediate links to the group. Sciences Po Bordeaux University analyst Jean Petou says the attack reflects a trend seen in Israel and elsewhere.
C'est la traduction ou la...
It's essentially a manifestation of low-cost terrorism, targeting those who are in the wrong place at the wrong time. The authors are individuals who strike without any preparation or demands, whether that be political or other types of demands. They have a suicidal logic.
Authorities have detained several people suspected of helping the assailant, who they say assumed multiple identities and passports. But there are questions about why the man, who was arrested several times here, including shortly before the killings, wasn't expelled from France.
C'est évidemment la question que je me pose et sur laquelle j'ai demandé une enquête.
Interior Minister Gérard Colomb says the government is looking into the matter. He told French radio the killer had Italian residence and a valid Tunisian passport. He's been identified as 29-year-old Ahmed Hanashi. After nearly two dozen terrorist incidents in recent years, including the Charlie Hebdo and the Bataclan attacks, the French are realizing that insecurity is here to stay. But art student Isman Poussin, out enjoying a sunny evening in Paris, is particularly sad about this latest strike.
All my family and all my friends in Marseille, and I feel that they are not safe in here. So I worry about them because I can't be here for them, and I think that's not the first attack there will be have in Marseille.
18-year-old Pierre Bourdin says the best answer to terrorism is defiance.
We try to go out to show that we are not going to show our fear about terrorism. So we go out a lot and we try to show terrorism will not win against France.
Je vais donc mettre aux voix le projet de loi. Chacun est bien face à son pupitre.
The government is offering another answer. French deputies passed a counter-terrorism bill this week that makes permanent several controversial measures under the country's two-year-old state of emergency. Some critics say it strips away basic rights. Others say it doesn't go far enough. Again, Jean Petou, a Sciences Po Bordeaux.
Moi, j'ai tendance à penser que quand un texte...
I'm inclined to think that when a text is criticized by opposing sides, it means it's pretty balanced. I believe the state of emergency that's been applied since 2015 is pretty much the minimum. You can't say public liberties have really suffered in a big way.
Rights groups and many Muslims sharply disagree. But with yet another terrorist attack possibly thwarted this week, an apparently failed bombing attempt in Paris, some French appear willing to trade less freedom for more security. That's the case of Pierre Bourdin, the Paris student, who says he supports the legislation pushed by President Emmanuel Macron.
This project of law, we feel that it will reduce our liberties. We are feeling uncomfortable about it, but he has to take all the precautions he can to guarantee the security of France.
The Senate is expected to follow the lower house in passing the bill, which essentially fulfills President Macron's promise, but translates some of its tough policing powers into permanent law. It's expected to be adopted before November 1st, when the temporary state of emergency expires. Lisa Bryant, DW, Paris.
And that's all we have time for on Spotlight on Europe. Remember, we would love to hear your response in an email via feedback.africa@dw.com. You can also find us on Facebook, DW Africa. Thanks to the rest of the team, Emma Wallis and our technician, Max Zimmer. We will be back next week with another edition of Spotlight on Europe. My name is Pora Nyambura. From all of us here at Deutsche Welle, have a wonderful week ahead. Oh,